Hello and welcome to Cranfield University. In this interview series, we explore the role of philosophy and humanities more broadly for management, engineering, and more broadly for our everyday lives. My name is Andrei Pavlov, and I'm Professor of Strategy and Performance here at the School of Management.
My name is Toby Thompson. I'm Director of this studio at Cranfield University. My interest is in executive education with an interest in Martin Heidegger.
And our guest today is Dr. David Goldberg, Emeritus Professor at the University of Illinois and President of 3Joy Associates. Dave, welcome to Cranfield.
Hey, Andre and Toby, it's great to be with you today.
Dave, can I ask, can I start with a very broad question? So you are an engineer, but I also know that you have a keen interest in philosophy, and you have been thinking about philosophy in engineering and philosophy of engineering for a couple of decades now. And I understand you've been at the origin of the current and the current development, current thinking in philosophy of engineering. So my broad question is, why does engineering need philosophy? What's the contribution of philosophy to engineering?
I think that's a great and fairly broad question. I think for me, as an engineer, a lot of my thinking has come from engineering as practice. As an engineering professor, the academy is often accused of, and some rightfully so, of teaching theory and not practice. And so I've been interested in that gap between theory and practice for some time. And for me, some clarity came when I started thinking about, well, how should engineering curriculums change to be more practice oriented in a way that was still academically respectable? And so I drew on my experience of teaching seniors, fourth year students in engineering in my department at Illinois. And we had a studio learning class, and so we would take them on real projects. And so you travel with three students and go out into the field and then watch them as they tried to tackle a real engineering problem. And it became clear to me that there was just this whole set of things that they really weren't very good at. I called them the missing basics of engineering. And so to be more specific, so you would go on this project with these students, and the first thing they needed to do was find out what the real project was, not the abstract that was prepared for them. So they needed to ask good questions, but they couldn't. They didn't know how to ask good questions. So at one point I gave a talk and I wrote some papers about this, and I called that a failure of Socrates 101, that they didn't know how to ask the kinds of piercing questions that helped them understand a problem. And then what didn't they know how to do? Well, they were told stories about the project in qualitative form, and they didn't know how to categorize things. So what was that? That was a failure of Aristotle 101. So there were all these things. There was a series of them that I wrote about that were kind of the gifts of philosophical thinking to the world. And yet here we had engineers being trained in a way where they couldn't fill the gaps in practice. So for me, the need for philosophy in engineering is oftentimes largely methodological, and fills in the gap between engineering as taught as math and science and applied science, as to kind of methods of inquiry to try to understand what problems really are in practice and then do something with them. So to me, it's a very practical thing. Even though philosophy is very high-minded and engineering as taught is very theoretical, the real need for philosophy is in engineering as practice.
It's really interesting because, so you're saying that you're, and correct me if I'm wrong, kind of you've spotted the need for philosophy and you spotted the need for thinking about engineering by thinking about how engineering is done rather than thinking about what it is. And to me, it sounds like a story of pragmatist philosophy, isn't it?
Well, it, yeah, so, yeah, so of course, every term you introduce, every philosophical term you introduce is laden with all kinds of
indeed
contexts, and then the, you know, so as soon as you say pragmatism, then you we immediately then jump into the modern era, and then we're talking about post-structuralism and deconstruction and things like that, that that came about from it. But I think, and yes, I think as engineering as a practical field that affects human beings' lives, it, it is a my interest was pragmatic, but it was also theoretical. So I was I was invoking certain theories. So I was in, you know, so when it, so to continue my story, so students then didn't, they had the data that they weren't able to label, then they weren't able to they weren't able to model very well. So that's, that goes to Hume, that's a failure of Hume 101, and notions of causality of one thing leading to another, and then and they didn't know how to categorize, and so that's a failure of Aristotle 102, and then they don't know how, then they've got this big problem that they need to decompose, that's a failure of Descartes 101, discourse on methods. So so it it's pragmatic and it's theoretical both. I'm appealing to the theories that we've learned in the course of history, especially things that are methodological as opposed to big systems of philosophy, and then how those can apply in the education of an engineer who's who's more able to go out on day one and do what engineers do.
Dave, I'm fascinated by what you say, because it sounds like you're saying engineering education isn't working or hasn't worked. What do you put that down to?
Well, I mean, so there's, I mean, so, and you know, we need to, there's no catastrophe. Engineers get hired. They do a job, but there's often this long period of apprenticeship where they learn to fill the, they learn to communicate, they learn to ask the questions, they learn to deal with real problems as they are, as opposed to idealizations of them that they're taught in school. So, so it's not a bad thing. Engineering is a highly paid profession, reasonably well respected. So it's not catastrophic. On the other hand, more and more in the world that we live in, engineering is expensive, and companies that hire engineers want them to be project ready on day one, and they're not. So there's a sense in which, yes, there's, there are these missing things, and if we could fill them, we would have, you know, people use the language of well-rounded engineers, things like that. And I think that there are gaps to fill. It's not catastrophic, but there are gaps to fill, and part of what fills them is some of these things that we can learn from philosophy.
So is it a case then of training kind of the reflective capacity in general, or is it something more specific, less specific? What's the nub of the issue, do you think?
Well, and my missing basics locution was kind of a first pass at it, and as I've thought about this more, it goes deeper. There are sort of deeper missing basics. So engineering as taught is very, very rational. It's all about thoughts and being in the head. But then when people complain about the impact of projects on, or projects or products on people, there's sometimes engineers are faulted for not accounting for how this affects people in their everyday lives. And so there's this, and some of that comes from remaining overly rational, not understanding the human, some of the emotional elements of being human, the cultural elements of being human, as well as the physical elements of being human. We're embodied creatures, and so the things that we design for human beings have to fit those bodies, have to fit how we live in certain ways. And so there's it goes deeper. And I think there's a lot of interest in those, in the motion and culture and the effects of technology on real human beings today, that's actually quite popular with students and young engineering faculty members.
I'm fascinated, Dave, of the book, the two books that you've done, the 2014 engineering book, and then you just got one out, Field Manual for Whole New Education. And you kind of do a 5-4-3-2-1, the five shifts, the four sprints and spirits, the three practices, the two keys, and the one main advantage. How should people consider revising their education based on that book?
Yeah, so I think the countdown list has quite a bit packed into it. But if we pick apart some of the most important pieces of it, it has to do with the and actually I've been talking in contraries. You know, I talked about theory and I've talked about practice and I've talked about mathematics and I've talked about qualitative thinking with words. I think one of the key things here is that excellence in engineering is excellence on both sides of those opposites, which seems hard to do. Sometimes we have this kind of either or thinking. So an engineer should be either analytically rigorous or qualitatively and communications wise competent. Well, no, actually great engineers should be both. They should be both qualitative and possibly rigorous qualitatively. And that philosophy certainly brings rigor to the words that we use and makes us more sensitive to the words that we use. But that doesn't mean that we're going to throw out the analytical baby with the bathwater, and then all of a sudden engineers won't be able to do their maths. Not at all. We want engineers who are good analytically, and we want them also to be able to handle qualitative stuff. We want them to design stuff that works, but we want them also to be sensitive to how that's used by the people that technology impacts. So there are, some people call these opposites that need each other polarities. I like the language of co-contraries. We have these co-contraries that need each other in that we want both parts to be excellent. We want and excellence of analytical rigor and qualitative and communicative ability. That's one of the things in the countdown of five shifts. We want to, instead of thinking always about problem solving once and for all, we actually are interested in creating systems that manage co-contraries. And we see this, and it sounds complicated, but it's not. Barry Johnson uses the analogy of breathing. Which is better, inhaling or exhaling? Well, you better do both or you're not gonna live. So which is better, individual work or teamwork? Well, in real project work, you need great individual work and great teamwork. Which is better, theory or practice? No, we want to be excellent in both. And so I think a lot of the things that a lot of my five shifts are talking about the ways in which engineering has become unbalanced and more to the analytical side and the rational side, and needs to be more balanced by paying attention to co-contraries, by paying attention to emotion and body, by paying attention to communication, by thinking about language as well as math and so forth. It seems to me that it's this kind of, and it's not a compromise balance. It's not we really want to get the best that we can. There is a trade-off, but we want both of the ends of important co-contraries to be respected in engineering as practice, engineering as taught.
But it sounds like you're expecting a change in the professors, a whole new professor, as well as possibly a whole new engineering student. What changes are you expecting there?
Well, and you can't, you really can't get one without the other. And so a lot of, that's why the focus of A Whole New Engineer was really about education and about what kinds of things did we have to do to retrain engineering faculty to have greater respect for some of these other things. And now these other things don't require a lot of time, and what I found is that small targeted efforts to reskill engineering faculty members can have big benefits in them being able to bring forward a new generation of engineers that have more of this and excellence on the important co-contraries.
I'm thinking about these systems for creating the synthesis of these co-contraries. I think I have a poorly formulated question, but I'm going to try and formulate it now.
I'll lay it on me. There's no such thing.
I suppose the traditional way of bringing these co-contraries together would be to teach technical disciplines separately and, let's say, humanities separately. Right, and we see it in management schools, you know, we see it in schools of engineering, I suppose. But correct me if I'm wrong, this is not what you're advocating, right? And so does that mean that, I suppose that side of the balance that has been neglected needs to be brought into the core of engineering? And the core of engineering studies, the core of engineering teaching and practice as well?
Yeah, so, I think that's not an ill-posed question, it's a great question. So first of all, there's no one right way to bring about these reforms. They're all situated in particular, you know, so if I go to Dublin City University or the National University of Singapore or the Federal University of Minas Gerais and start working with people there. The situation there is there are similarities to engineering education around the world, but there are important cultural differences. And so any move you make to bring about change is dependent on where the culture is, the accreditation boards in those countries, the professional engineering boards in those countries. So there are all kinds of both obstacles and opportunities and when you go into a different place. So there's not one right way. Now, to go back to, so this kind of separation of humanities and engineering, you can effectively, there are ways for teaching engineers in separate courses, better ways to communicate, even though they're not brought into engineering. So, for example, when I went to National University of Singapore back about 10 years ago, they took the missing basics locution in both a presenting course and a communications course, and rather than having the students write clever essays about high-level technical problems, they addressed things that were actually more near and dear to a young engineer's heart in ways that address the missing basics more directly. But they were still classes taught separately by people with a humanities training for engineers. But of course, then there are ways that you can bring these together. So for example, at Olin College, there's this wonderful material science course where a historian and a material scientist work together, and then they examine, say, historical examples of material science. So, for example, Paul Revere was a worked with metal, and so they looked at things like how were nails made in the 1700s, and the students did experiments on historically based things. So that's a wonderful kind of mixing of the humanities and engineering, both in a way that tells students that they're not separate, that it's okay to have historical thoughts and think about historical perspective at the same time that you're thinking about, you know, modern material science. So there are many ways to do better. So and they're all dependent on where you're starting from. But it seems to me that there are some principles that some of them come from philosophical reflection about what's missing. Some of them are inspired by the results of philosophy fairly directly.
A follow-up question then. What sort of reception do you encounter to these ideas? Do you feel like you're pushing on an open door, or do you feel or do you see resistance to this? Both in terms of kind of the overall idea of redressing this balance, but also to the idea of bringing philosophy more explicitly into this.
Yeah. So it's both. I mean, so there. It'll be culturally. It'll be culturally determined. It's hard to generalize. I was trained as a civil engineer. Civil engineering is involved with technology. We were talking before we started about sanitation engineering. Affects our lives directly. And civil engineers build bridges and roads and things that affect us fairly directly. And are also fairly transparent. And so we can see how the bridges are made, at least outwardly. We can see the sewage treatment plant. So there are ways in which bringing philosophy and things into that kind of field is easier than computer science or electrical engineering, where the advances have kind of been largely built on, if you take electrical engineering and in the late 1800s and the invention of radio and the electrification of the world, a lot of that was largely driven by Maxwell's equations and theoretical understanding. So the culture in electrical engineering tends to place greater emphasis on the theoretical side. And so sometimes you might expect a little bit more resistance there. But what I found is that one of the ways in is to work with people on skills that they already think they're good at. So I started with Socrates the failure of Socrates 101. Actually some of my method now actually draws on some training I took when I left the university. I took training at Georgetown University as an executive coach, and executive coaches are taught to listen in a very deep way and ask open-ended questions that help open people up and get them to see what their real challenges are. And so if we start with those skills that are so basic that we don't even think of them anymore. And that's actually one of the challenges, is to get people to participate in such things as, you say, hey, let's do some work on noticing, listening, and questioning. At 3Joy, we use the acronym NLQ. You say, well, yeah, NLQ, check, check, check. I'm really great at all three. But actually, a part of what I learned when I took training as an executive coach was, actually, there's lots of room for the average bear to improve. I took the training in my 50s, and I was surprised how impactful it was to notice differently, listen differently, and question differently. And so I like to start with things like that, where you can demonstrate on a very personal level the value of being better at kind of really personal inquiry. I was going to use the term critical inquiry, but critical inquiry is maybe in some sense too directly tied to philosophy. Is if you can make it personal, then things seem to open up. And I've had many aha moments where people use, say, the NLQ training that we do to then open up a situation at home and listen differently and make family problems go away. And so that's actually an interesting possibility too. And so if we can do things that make people better engineers, but also make them more capable family members, partners, human beings, in ways where they are more curious and interested in their fellow human being, that seems to me to be a good thing too.
It's interesting because a critic maybe of this series that we're watching here today would say that there's more than one solution. And are we trying to get people to think independently, or are we trying to get people to think like us, like philosophers? How would you respond to that?
Well, my religious background I'm Jewish, and so there's this joke among Jews: if you put five Jews in a room, you have seven opinions. It seems to me that the same is true about philosophers. And my experience with philosophers is they have widely disparate views. And actually, philosophy is great for sorting things out. It's not really great for settling issues. So I don't think there's any danger of settling things or getting people to be too homogeneous by introducing philosophical thinking into the mix. And I said that for me, a lot of what was valuable in philosophy for engineering was methodological. So it's essentially, okay, how do we think differently? How do we use words more often than equations, or start with words and move to equations? How do we reflect? How do we decompose? How do we gather data? How do we visualize those sorts of things? How do we pay attention to our emotions? That I was interested in your interest in Heidegger. And so a lot of the philosophy I've been talking about, people could categorize as analytic philosophy, that's mm-hmm. kind of more precise. But it seems to me that the continental tradition of kind of digging into what it means to be in the, to be thrown into the world and to be a human being, and what's emotion, back to Nietzsche and so forth, and all the things that kind of open up modern psychology and psychoanalysis. It seems to me that those things are of interest. And again, the philosophy won't. I was careful to say that when you're going in to help bring about change, you're basically going in with a toolkit that helps open things up to change. But what you change and what should be changed remains a project for the reader, or the project for the department. So a department said, well, in what ways do your students, when they graduate, feel that their education served them? In what ways do your alumni think that their education led them to a great career? In what ways do the employers of your students think that the people that they hired were ready or not ready for what they did? In what ways does your government, if the government sponsors your education, think that the education is serving the country? And so those questions remain, and they're big questions and important questions. When I work specifically to bring about change, there's some thinking about gaps, but they're largely methodological gaps in terms of what things should be taught. Those things remain an open question. So I think the these processes could be misused by people, or people could interpret them as the one right way. And I would just say here that there have been people that have said that a whole new engineer wanted to bring about a whole generation of fluffy engineers, and nothing could be further from the truth. So it's a misreading of the goals of those two books to say things like that, or to say that it's just one right way. There's no room for creativity or difference. There's really lots of room for difference.
I'm trying to picture a fluffy engineer now. Please.
It's interesting. I think I'm just listening to you and reflecting on also other conversations that Toby and I have had in this interview series. And I think the recurrent theme is, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the value of philosophy is not so much in the, say, the history of the philosophical ideas, but in the analytical power and nuance of philosophical thinking, or of thinking that philosophy brings to various questions. So it's more about doing philosophy than studying philosophy, I suppose. Would that be correct?
I would agree with that. Although I was just hinting that the broad outline. So then, if you look at analytic kind of philosophy and kind of rigorous attempts to sort out, so I'm a big fan. Actually, one of the elements of big elements of coaching that was brought to us by an engineer named Fernando Flores when he did a interdisciplinary dissertation at Berkeley was bringing speech acts philosophy into management and also into engineering. So there's an example of analytic philosophy having an impact that has now reflected not only in education but in all these coaches that are being turned out because speech acts are a fundamental piece of what every executive coach are taught. But then people forget that it was Hubert Dreyfus was his John Searle was one advisor and Dreyfus was his other, and he brought in a respect for Continental and Heidegger and notions of being and almost an Eastern kind of approach to philosophy that brings in if you think about my co-contrary language, there's a yin and a yang kind of balance to that that is reflected in Heideggerian kinds of thought. So it's not that the different strains influence us only in method, but their broad scope influences us on the breadth of what it means to be human.
Well, that's loving to hear. There isn't a Western exceptionalism. Maybe you'd say there was. Part of me, Dave, can't quite figure out yet. Sometimes engineers can't fail. And there are some things they simply need to know and they simply need to be taught versus the amazing things you said about those, the softer side. And you talk about emotional intelligence. I'm still trying to reconcile those two things. You don't see there to be a tension. Maybe I'm making too much of it.
So let me make sure I understand the point. So certain things that they can't fail at So just say a little bit more on that.
So if you're building a bridge, if you're building a bridge, there's certain things you need to know. It cannot fail. You can fail in designing of the bridge, but when you build it, it simply cannot fail. So there's certain things that are not negotiable. And yet, a lot of the things you've said so far, and I completely agree with you, seem to be representing a humane education, which is just good generally, I think.
Right. Yeah, so, first of all, when we actually practically look at output from education, we fail a lot. So we graduate a lot of engineers that actually don't know much about beam bending for your bridge, or they don't know much about anaerobic versus aerobic bacteria for their sewage treatment plant. So when we actually, and we make the mistake of thinking that because we've covered something that it's known. But at the larger point you're making, I would agree. And actually I've already shielded myself. I'm not saying that we shouldn't teach beam building and the different types of bacteria that are in a sewage treatment plant. Absolutely, those things should be taught. And is there some way for us to have those taught at a high level, as high or reasonably close to as high as we have right now, and have engineers who graduate who more easily fit into a management role and don't piss off everyone that they work with as soon as they take the job. I have two grown sons who both work in the software and field, and without mentioning companies, I've just been kind of appalled given what we, and you guys are in a business school, so we know a lot about organizational behavior, we know about a lot about leadership, and yet some of the managerial practices of this stuff take me back to the 50s when Theory X and Theory Y were first came about. It's like we haven't made any progress whatsoever. So maybe some of these things, and engineering organizations are large organizations where people are managed, and if they're managed well, they tend to do better jobs more competently. Maybe some of these other things that we're kind of just skipping, a little bit of addressing the basics, at least at some level, but more importantly, practicing a respect and a curiosity for the students that we teach would translate into a different way of these organizations being led as business schools have been teaching for, what, the 50s to now, you know, 75 years.
Answer that, Andre.
yeah, exactly. I suppose I have a couple more questions for you, Dave.
Sure.
What about education, I think, since we're talking about education? And then I also want to ask you to talk a little bit more about your executive coaching practice as well. Going back to education, one of the things that I've noticed, kind of bringing philosophy to the management classroom, is that on the undergrad level, there's quite a lot of resistance, and maybe there's quite a lot of there's quite a lot of skepticism about, you know, why do I need this? Right? Why do I need these ideas? Why do I need these tools? But actually, Cranfield is an entirely postgraduate university. And so we have people who come back after work to do their master's or doctorate or executive education. And perhaps surprisingly, perhaps paradoxically, you would expect these people to be even more skeptical about philosophy, but they're not. And I think one of the lessons that I've learned was that it's the people who have been out there and who have struggled with questions that have no answers and with kind of real world problems that have developed a keen interest in philosophy. And so this is a long preamble to a question. What do you think engineering education should look like at different levels, kind of the bachelor's, master's, and executive or professional?
First of all, I just respond to your preamble. It seems to me that your observation sounds exactly right, that people out in the world who have experienced, you know, so they went in with the education that emphasized technical skills over the other things, then feel the need to come back and backfill with some of the human side. Now, in the olden days, that meant, at least in this country, and I guess other countries too, I'm not sure what the status of the MBA is anymore, but that led many of your students at the graduate level in business were engineers at the undergraduate level. And that's the case in a lot of management schools in this country. So they're filling the gaps of their education with this, with thinking about, well, what is a business? How does it fit into, what is an economy? What does it mean to lead? All these questions that come up in a business school that we don't talk about in engineering.
If you allow me to interrupt you, indeed.
No, please.
But on the typical MBA program, they would still find that they're learning they're still learning technical solutions and kind of frameworks, and quick answers, maybe in a different discipline, but, you know, still quite technical. And for me, the interesting thing was to spot the thirst and the hunger for kind of the big ideas and the questions of philosophy there.
Yeah. Well, that was the case, and that you found that need and that there is a thirst for it makes a lot of sense. I guess the short answer to the larger question is I don't know. And again, my respect for different cultures, and like I've what management education or engineering education is in the UK and how it should be different versus how it should be different in the US or even at a particular school, I wouldn't want to give a direct answer. I would say that there are key co-contraries to excellence at each of the levels that are unbalanced, and that we need to do just enough so that we, if the technical solutions and the quick fixes that you talked about are valuable, that they need to, and those are considered important, we need to continue doing those, and we need to bring in enough of the other stuff so that the person goes out and has a more balanced look. Now, there are many ways to do that. So one of the things I've noticed in management education, not so much in engineering graduate education, is different schools giving students, like master's students, a coach so that they can work one-on-one with someone and help them develop, what is your management philosophy? What kind of career is it that you're trying to have? And work with them kind of as an individual to kind of sort themselves out to go into the world.
Indeed, yeah, we do that as well.
I think that's a really interesting solution that can then just in time balance some of these things individual by individual. But I also think there are things that you can do at the level of the curriculum that if you're not teaching deep NLQ, well, that's just a few hours of exposure gets you to a really great place. If you're not teaching polarities or co-contraries, that's a few hours of introduction that you can never unsee. And those are my five shifts. And actually some of them are business oriented. So for example, a lot of engineering and a lot of traditional big organization business is about planning the hell out of stuff. Planning as a means to starting and getting the thing that you want at the end. And of course, Sarah Sarasvati in her dissertation with Herb Simon kind of opened up, well, what is it that entrepreneurs do that is different? Yep. And she said, they make kind of plans, but then those plans, that rubber hits the road and they don't work. And so they effectuate. Or I like Peter Sims' term, they then make little bets and actually sometimes end up not actually achieving the goals that they set out to achieve, but they end up being successful in some way. So one of my co-contraries is between planning, which is the dominant paradigm, and entrepreneurial thinking broadly considered, not just for businesses, to where you are experimental and you make little bets and you understand how to navigate a VUCA world.
As you're speaking, Dave, I'm thinking of the UK's Royal Society's motto, nullius in verba, take nobody's word for it. And it sounds almost insurgent, just because Dave says it or we've said it, don't take our word for it. You are looking for independent thinkers, by the sound of it, people that really can take on the responsibility and the ownership for all of the decisions that they take. That's huge, huge. So my question, as an educator, someone watching this series, I'm an engineering educator. What's the first thing I should do aside from buy your book? Well, no, okay, buy your book. Because they've got to affect change, right?
The educator. What's the first thing? At first thing, an educator, an individual educator sitting in a department. It seems to me that there's no one right answer to that question. Mm-hmm. It does seem to me that take nobody's word for it. There, you can have an impact. You can be a I hate the term influencer, not an influencer in the sense of doing funny videos on TikTok, but an influencer in the sense of helping people ask different questions and think differently about things. And so it seems to me that and a number of my experiences were experiences without permission. So, for example, the iFoundry insurgency at Illinois was came about when Andreas Kangalaris, who's now president of this new school that they're opening in the desert in Saudi Arabia, NEOM. But anyways, at the time, he was just an electrical engineering professor. He came to me, he was talking about, well, how do we have students, how do we create engineering students that are more innovative? And I talked about some of my ideas, and he said, well, Dave, we should do that now. I'm going to go to the dean. So he goes to our dean, who comes back, and Andreas says, Dave, great news. The dean wants to appoint a committee, and he wants us to help write the charge. And I got pissed off. I said, no, I am not going to be on another committee that meets and meets and does and talks and talks and talks and then doesn't do anything. So that led to some reflection about, well, what can you do as an individual without appointment from the dean? And so we created the Illinois Foundry for, at the time it was a Tech Vision, but the name changed to the Illinois Foundry for Innovation in Engineering Education. But at first it was just an insurgency, and then so Andreas and I met, and then we got some of our colleagues that were interested, and then we got some students interested. We got humanists and social scientists across the, and artists. We went to the School of Art and Design. We got all kinds of people together, and we just started meeting and having seminars and things like that to talk about, well, how are things, what are things, do we like the way things are? And then that led, actually at first it was just a seminar series, and that seminar series turned into iFoundry. They're sort of parallel efforts in bringing people together and having kind of a committee or working group assigned to engineering. So I would say, what should you do? So buy the book and do something. because what you can do will depend on who your colleagues are. And don't just think about colleagues in your department. Think about colleagues in your college or school or faculty. And think about colleagues outside your faculty and colleagues in another place altogether. So part of the success of iFoundry was reaching out to then upstart Olin College and saying, hey, why don't you guys, we're one of the big bad David, Goliaths of engineering education. You guys are the little David. Instead of throwing stones at each other, why don't we partner? And we did. We formed a formal partnership with them. And then so reaching out to this kind of innovative place helped make Illinois more innovative, but it also helped Olin understand in a deeper way what it was they had actually accomplished.
Inspiring.
I'll come back to my question about your executive coaching practice, because I just want to follow up on what you've just said. So you brought quite a lot of different people together. As you say, people from different backgrounds. It strikes me that so this is also what you've done with the forum on the philosophy, engineering, and technology, right? Can you talk a little bit more about that space? Can you talk a little bit more about that space and the ideas that have kind of bubbled up in that space for the past 15 years that you've been involved in it?
Well, and actually, all these things historically and personally kind of tie together to the same period around 2005, 2006. So iFoundry was 2006, 2007 was, I think, the white paper. There was engineering and science studies at Illinois. And anyways, all these things were at about the same time, but actually they were tied to another book. I wrote a book called The Entrepreneurial Engineer that was for senior engineers to get them to be better writers and some of the missing basics. And I was promoting that on a blog of the same name. And so in, I think it was April 2006, I write this blog post why isn't there a philosophy of engineering like there's a detailed philosophy of science? And I got a note back and from someone in the UK, a fellow named Andrew Fox, and he says, oh, well, the Institution of Civil Engineers here is interested in that. And did you know that your own Academy of Engineering is interested, National Academy of is interested in the same question. There's a ad hoc committee. I said, no, I don't know that. So I went poking around. There was a website. I knew some of the guys on it. So I started to ask questions, and one thing led to another. And it was the first name for it was the Workshop on Philosophy and Engineering, WPE. And the first one was held in 2007 in Delft. And they had maybe 60, 70 people come, but it was a wonderful meeting. And it was mainly philosophers and engineers, but we also had sort of humanists of different stripe. There were historians and people that interested in the social studies of science, organization, their conference called 4S, so some of those people came. And then just kind of interested engineers came. And so, That grew from that first meeting. We had a meeting the next year in London, sponsored by the Royal Academy and Natasha McCarthy, and I co-chaired that. Anyway, so there was this went on for a while. There was at one point one of these academic catfights where one group wanted to do it one way and another group wanted to do it another way. So I grabbed some of the better philosophers and we went off and did it our way, and that was called the Forum on Philosophy, Engineering, and Technology. And that's the other one kind of just, they didn't do anything and they died. So, that one has survived about every 2 years. We got messed up by the lockdown. We did have a virtual meeting in 2020. We wanted to have one, and we usually have them in the even years. We wanted to have it in 2022. We couldn't pull it off. But we had just had one in 2023, so it's been going on here for 17 years. But it's just been this wonderfully eclectic, diverse group of philosophers, engineers, humanists of different stripes, applied science, computer scientists, applied scientists of different stripes. It's been great. And there's a series of books. They have blue and red covers called From the Poet Series: Philosophy of Engineering and Technology by Springer. There's a journal that's ongoing. There's actually several. There's a journal called Engineering Studies that publishes some of these things. And then there's a philosophy and technology journal that publishes some of this work. It's a little bit tough to get academic engineers to play in this space.
Because they don't get rewarded
for writing philosophy papers the way that philosophers get rewarded for writing philosophy papers. But it's not as bad as it once was. And there are departments, like in my country, there are departments of engineering education that are more qualitative in nature and more about how do we educate engineers. Those people get brownie points for writing these kinds of papers. So it's a little better than it once was. But I'm just tickled pink that it, you know, here we are 17 years later and the darn thing's still going.
Where would you like to see it go? What's your ambitions for it?
Well, I'm fairly ecumenical in terms of my interests. I'm interested in the conversation going where it needs to go. And it's gone where you might think it's gone, you know, so with the rise of AI, transhumanism, we've had people talking about that and concerns for the environment and environmental justice and things like we've had people talking about that on both sides. Hopefully we can keep the argument from becoming propaganda for the World Economic Forum. But the conversation's has gone kind of content-wise exactly where you would think it would go, given the evolution of technology and some of the critical problems we face in the world today. A lot of my problems are again more practical ones. How can I ensure that this little pea shooter of a conference can survive institutionally? I'd like to see it affiliate with substantial organizations that are likely to be around in 100 years. Maybe the Royal Academy, the National Academy on the engineering side, philosophically, perhaps the Society for Philosophy and Technology. Are there ways that we can ensure institutionally the survival of this conversation? And can we, also as a practical matter, can we ensure the kind of diversity of debate, intellectual diversity of debate that we've had thus far? So for, and I had some experience of that in my previous research area of a kind of AI based on natural systems. Everyone talks about neural nets today, but there's also systems that are based, evolutionary and genetic algorithms based on survival of the fittest and genetic metaphors instead of neural network metaphors. And one of the things to learn from evolutionary biology is that if you have a particular niche with certain resources, over time, one organism fills that niche. So if you want to have philosophers and engineers in the same conference, you need to have a way where we preserve diversity, where philosophers and engineers are both valued. If you want to have two sides of something presented, you want to make sure that that diversity is somehow represented in the structure of the organization. I know that the nuts and bolts of running a conference aren't really what we're talking about, but I guess what I'm talking about here is the application of philosophical and scientific ideas to the creation of institutions that can be long-lasting, and I think that's a worthy thing.
Indeed, and I suppose my question about that is, you've been involved in this for quite a long time, and do you see any trends in this? Are we getting more interest in the kind of cross-pollination between philosophy and practical professions? Are we getting less interest? How's this whole space developing, do you think?
Yeah, well, it's hard, sometimes attendance can help. I think we had something like 60-70 attendees in 2007. This year in Delft, we had 150 plus. And we were space limited. Our facilities couldn't handle more than that. So so I'm encouraged. I'm encouraged by that. I'm not worried about the philosophy or the humanist side of this, because, like I said, those people get points for writing papers about this stuff. I'm encouraged that there are places for engineers to publish papers on engineering education and engineering as a profession more so, and that those count now in ways that they didn't. And actually, part of what one of the things that I noticed when we did iFoundry, at the time we did iFoundry at the University of Illinois, to spend any time at all on engineering education and improving it as an assistant professor meant that in 6 years you would be looking for another job at another university. And part of what happened in the culture shift that took place after iFoundry, that, hey, this stuff is really pretty good. We didn't die by touching it, and actually it brought some value to the university and to our graduates, that when you engage in the right kind of organizational change, that then it opens up the possibility of people writing about and thinking about different things. So I'm hopeful. For me, I think the conference can take care of itself, but we'll get more engineers attending it if we can bring about some of these changes in engineering education, where being better rounded and more having more respect for qualitative rigor it goes along with the analytical rigor that we already imprint onto the minds of young engineers.
Mm. And Dave, can I finally ask you to talk a little bit more about your executive coaching practice? Because you're an engineer, you're essentially a practical philosopher as well, and you're an executive coach. It's a very unusual combination. Tell us a little bit more about what you do and what's your focus and who are your clients.
Well, so, and it was unusual, but I'm not sure that it still is. And actually, so there's at the 2022 conference, I met a young woman who was just finishing her PhD, who had taken training as an executive coach. She had an engineering PhD and she took training as a coach. And actually, we wrote a paper. It's kind of, I think it's just out in the latest volume that has come out of the FPET series about kind of sort of the, it wasn't called Perspectives of an Old Guy and a young woman, but it was something, but it was sort of, well, our different motives for this and what we thought the value was. But anyways, the, for me, again, the becoming a coach was the natural outgrowth of a practical problem. So I was the co-chairman of this iFoundry initiative. I was thinking about, oh, maybe I should go become a dean or a department head or something like that. And so I hired a coach to help me sort that out. And I applied for some jobs. I was doing pretty well in the searches. I probably could have gotten one of them. And there was a moment where I was turned down for a job as a department head at one of the engineering education departments. And my coach had previously asked me, well, what, Dave, what's your plan B if I don't get one of these? And I hung up from that call where I was turned down, and I wasn't upset about being turned down, but it was, they hired an internal candidate. I had suspected he was going to get the job anyways. It wasn't that, but at that moment I took a piece of paper out and wrote down plan B, resign from University of Illinois, take an early retirement, start a company and go out in the world and help change engineering education.
Wow.
And the more I looked at that plan B, I said, oh, that's actually what I want to do. So I was in the middle of these searches. They hadn't resolved. I just resigned from all the searches I was in. And then I went to my associate dean that I work for at Illinois. I said, hey, if I take an early retirement, will you guys bring me back for a little bit? So I nailed down my first client. I got calls from Singapore and Brazil to help them out. So anyway, so I had some business but one of the first things I did was talking to my coach, I said, where did you learn how to ask these great questions that you ask? And she said, oh, I went to Georgetown. She was a Georgetown graduate as a lawyer. She went back there for this coaching. And I said, well, gosh, I'd like to do that. Would you write me a letter of recommendation? She said, sure. Anyway, I got in and so that was the beginning of it. And but it was a wonderful late career. There's this nice, Arthur Brooks has this nice book out now, From Strength to Strength, about the things that you do as a young person where your mind is agile and really firing on all cylinders, and what you can do later as an older person where you're not quite as quick, but you have all this knowledge. And kind of transitioning into away from being a hired gun in evolutionary computation AI to being a hired helper for people that were trying to straighten out their academic careers as well as straighten out their departments, just been a real blessing to do this kind of work later in my career.
My last question then, what inspires you at the moment? What are you reading? What's on your bedside table?
Yeah, well, actually, so there isn't really a single book right now that's kind of got me going, but the thing that's got me going right now is an experience that I had in Ireland last year when finally the world opens up again and I finally got the ability to get on an airplane and do this work again. And so I was working with young faculty members, this isn't betraying a competence because the person I was working for wrote a nice testimonial for the book. But so I was working with these young faculty members at Dublin City University, and I had this realization that all the stuff that I've been talking about for helping reshape engineering education and higher education more generally is actually fundamental to being a great professor. So if you can balance the five shifts in your career and use these things in branding your research, in being a more effective teacher, and things like that. That you know, being faculty member is a really tough job, done well. And so what I've been thinking about is how can I make the case for using these same skills that I've been advocating for reworking things at the department level to kind of reworking things at the individual professor level. And this actually goes back to one of the questions you asked early on. It's like, do the faculty have to be reworked? Well, they do that to be better educators, but they also still have to jump through all the hoops of getting the tenure and writing enough papers and being well-regarded as an expert. And so I've been trying to think about what kind of text or what kind of teaching materials would inspire the next generation of faculty members to do it well as a researcher, as a teacher, as an influencer of the public generally.
What's the answer?
Oh, that's not fair.
Yeah, as a faculty member, I want to know what's the answer.
So I'm happy to come to Cranfield and do this work with your faculty on a moment's notice. We can
nice.
I can put you in touch with
Dave's good. Dave's very good.
No, but anyways, no. And so, but I think so. But to not be flippant about it, I think you referred to my latest book, A Field Manual for a Whole New Education. It starts with these five shifts. What are the really the shifts aren't that we should go full hog towards the shift, but how do we essentially hidden in the shifts are five co-contraries that we need to manage differently. To me, being effective as a teacher, changing departments, and actually dealing with we just briefly talked about AI, dealing with the digital gaggle that we're now surrounded with and ChatGPT, all of these things depend on managing those five shifts much differently than we do now. And if we do, we'll have a more human education, we'll have faculty that more easily jump through the hoops of becoming a great professor, and then we'll have business leaders and engineers and other professionals that are more able to take the roles that they're needed to take and the challenges ahead.
Fantastic. Dave, this Wow. was a fantastic conversation. We really enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. Thank you so much for sharing your insights and for sharing your time as well.
Dave, thank you so much. I know what book's on your nightstand now is your book. Fantastic. I'm going to buy me a copy.
Thanks, Guy. I enjoyed the conversation. Well, I love the idea of this series. And I love the idea of injecting the philosophy, however you can inject it into management education. So keep up the great work, and thanks for having me.
Brilliant. You heard it here first.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks a lot.